Okay, I've distributed two sheets. The one is properly referenced, and that was just a guide as I proceed. And the second one is taken from an article by Chris Harman from an issue of International Socialism some years back called From Feudalism to Capitalism, and I wanted us at some point just to focus on a particular paragraph from Harman. So today we're looking at the first parts of the Communist Manifesto and then at David Harvey's The Condition of Postmodernity. The manifesto was written by Marx and his lifelong collaborator, Friedrich Engels. It was prepared for a meeting of an international association of workers, which was held in London in November 1847. It was actually, the meeting was held at the Red Lion pub, which still exists on Great Windmill Street. It's had a checkered past recently. It was turned into a ghastly a gastro pub at one point, but it's now gone back to being the Red Lion. Not that it's necessarily better as the Red Lion, but that's it. The point was, it was published in January 1848, immediately before the outburst of revolutionary agitation that would shake the whole of Europe and give fresh content and political life to the events of 1789. So 1789-1848, two massive upheavals or convulsions in the within a couple of generations. To give a sense of how widespread those upheavals were, this is a map of Western Europe. If you look at the red circles are the areas in which there was various kinds of uprisings. Not all workers' uprisings, but many of them were. And you get a sense of the tremendous kind of shock waves which spread through the whole continent, with signal exceptions. You'll notice Great Britain not convulsed, and also the Kingdom of Spain, as it then was, not convulsed either. But elsewhere, including in parts of North Africa, there were tremendous upsurges in this period. And it's in this context that Marx is writing, very attentive to the developments across the whole continent. They begin the manifesto by referring to communism as a spectre which is haunting Europe, they say. And the point, I think, is by spectre, they obviously mean a ghost-like figure that haunts the present. And the communist spectre, as they see it, is not to be understood in the light of a return of the repressed. If you think of the way in which ghosts or spectre figures occur in lots of Gothic fiction, it's often some memory or something from the past, some atavistic thing which returns. The interesting thing about Marx and Engels' notion of the spectre is that it's the future that's been, perhaps that's it, trying to get in. it's a future happening that's being referred to. A special kind of future for them, since it promises both to transform the existing order of things, and in so doing, to redeem the past. And we'll see more about, we'll talk more about that idea of the redeeming of the past when we look at Walter Benjamin's essays on history later on, I think, in week 10. So what I want to do today, mostly, is to use the extracts that we've read to extend our discussion about modernity, about the modern age. What this means is that I'm not going to focus in any particularly substantive way on what Marx and Engels are arguing in the manifesto. It's reasonably clear in any event, and we can certainly discuss the substance of what they write. It's very interesting that a text written in 1848 should have a strange kind of contemporaneity at various other moments across the history. It's what's coming up now for 170 or so years. And that's the sense of a tremendous research. It was very striking that, in 1998, in other words, exactly 150 years after it, the text was multiply reprinted because it seemed to have a lot to say about the contemporary kind of crises of capitalism. The same thing happened in 2008 with the more recent crises. That this text seems to have something to say to the present. And it has done for a long period of time, but we can talk about that in seminar if it comes up. What I want to do is to look at this text in some sense of to discuss with you the ways in which Marx and Engels are thinking. So what they say is obviously unique, and any detailed study of the manifesto would need to investigate how it's similar to and how it differs from other writings of its time and place, the mid-1840s. But let me suggest that in one respect at least, the line of argument in the manifesto, I mean the way of thinking that's in evidence in it, is quite typical or representative. It exemplifies what Jürgen Habermas has called the philosophical discourse of modernity. This title I'm taking from Habermas's book here, called The Philosophical Discourse of Modernity. And so what I'm suggesting is that in some ways the manifesto is a participant in this much wider discourse. If you look at Habermas's book, and perhaps the first chapter is very important, you'll see that in the handout I've excerpted passages from that, with Habermas's usual sort of punchy sense. He's called the first chapter "Modernity's Consciousness of Time and Its Need for Reassurance." He does need, doesn't he, a kind of a journalistic editor to make something. But it's that sense of the concept of time and the need for reassurance that he's talking about. And I'm hoping that your reading of Harvey's work on time-space compression will have equipped you to understand this representative aspect of Marx and Engels's pamphlet. So let's start at the beginning then. They understand capitalism, first of all, as an historical formation. Its various features, they say, can only be explained on the basis of their historical emergence and development. And this point, I think, can't be overemphasized. The sense in which to understand a phenomenon, you need to historicize it. If you look at the way in which their argument is produced, over and over again, they're making historical kinds of claims. From the serfs of the Middle Ages sprang the discovery of America, the rounding of the Cape opened up. Meantime, the markets kept growing. And their conclusion, we see, therefore, how the bourgeoisie of the capitalist era is itself the product of a long course of development, of a series of revolutions in the modes of production and of exchange. I'm mentioning this for a variety of reasons. One of them, obviously, is to suggest that there is a continuous narrative that underlines the way in which Marx and Engels think about the present, that they think of the present as a series of developments in some sense. Even though in some of what they say in the manifesto, it appears that continuous way of thinking is going to be disturbed in some sense. And let's then focus immediately on this aspect. Capitalism represents the great transformation that they focus. It's a big ditch in human history. And I'm taking the title of The Great Transformation from Karl Polanyi's very important book of about 1950, I think, which was called The Great Transformation. Capitalism, for Marx and Engels, changes everything. Some of the most celebrated passages in the manifesto are those in which they describe the revolutionary features of bourgeois society. And I want you to to take this point very centrally, that in some sense, obviously what they're interested in is in a sense a revolution which breaks with capitalism, but you need to understand that for them capitalism is itself revolutionary in its effect. It changes all aspects of society. This extraordinary passage, which is so much cited, has been ever since they wrote it. If you look at their rhetoric, it's quite difficult to get a fix on it. In fact, if you ask the question, are they for or against the capitalist revolution? Do they see it as a good thing or as a bad thing? And it's a complicated passage. I mean, Frederick Jameson writes at one point in commenting on Marx that. That we have to understand that for Marx, capitalism is at one and the same time both the best thing that could ever have happened and the worst thing that could ever have happened. That strange sense of the doubleness. But if you look at it, it pitilessly tear asunder the feudal ties. So the sense in which capitalism absolutely tears up the script of the pre-existing social formation. So that man no longer has natural superiors. That idea, for instance, if you think of the effect of capitalism on, let's say, the divine right of kings, or the notion that the aristocracy is naturally superior, it leaves no other nexus between man and man than naked self-interest, he says. And it's difficult, as I say, to understand exactly how we can position this. There's something. There is something good, or at least in a sense graspable, about the idea that the forms of domination that exist in capitalist society are transparent. They can be observed. Previously, the suggestion was they were euphemized or disguised underneath the rubric of religion, for instance. He speaks then of the it's drowned the most heavenly ecstasies of religious fervor, of chivalrous enthusiasm in the icy water of egotistical calculation. So it murders the social order of the past and the rationality of that order, and leaves us then with it substitutes naked, shameless, direct, brutal exploitation. It's not that it ends exploitation, but it makes that exploitation purely economic. And this is the significance of it. Of course, the fact that exploitation still exists is Marx politics, or Marx and Engels' politics. They're interested in abolishing exploitation altogether. But something happens in capitalist society to exploitation. If you contrast this with any religious-centered order, for instance, whether you're thinking of Buddhism, for instance, Hinduism, Christendom, Islam, where all of those, in some sense, intersperse the form of religiosity as a cover for kinds of domination, whether of members of the working class, of women, of those without caste, for instance. However one understands this. Think of the role of religion, and for Marx, capitalism, in a sense, hives all of that stuff off. What's left is only this shameless, direct, brutal exploitation. So let's not suppose, though, that from the apocalyptic nature of that discourse, I mean, this is a tremendously apocalyptic passage. What's being described under the rubric of revolution, capitalism revolutionizes, we shouldn't suppose that this process is then abrupt, sudden, once and for all. Some famous passages in the manifesto seem to evoke a transformation that is as sudden and rapid as it is total. But those, I think, are potentially misleading. Think of those passages. All fixed, fast, frozen relations with their train of ancient prejudices and opinions are swept aside. All new form ones become antiquated before they can ossify. All that is solid melts into air, he says. This sounds as though it's a kind of once and for all immediate process. When we think of revolution, we think of it as fairly short in some sense. I'm thinking, looking forward to what we're going to be reading next term, if you think of the title of Rob Nixon's book about environmental despoilation, the title is Slow Violence. And Nixon is suggesting that, in fact, that we tend not to think of violence or revolution as slow. We tend to think of it as spectacular, rapid, instantaneous in some way. And Marx's language, I say Marx, but obviously you must take it as read, but I mean Marx and Engels, all of these. I think it's Engels' fate always to be forgotten in those. But the language suggests, doesn't it, a kind of rapidity, speed, the present. The point is that those passages just as the passages would seem to be enthusiastic about capitalism typically forget that the writings of Marx and Engels are notable also for their recording and protesting the violence of expropriation, the systematized misery and servitude that the imposition of capital's social relations visits on populations elsewhere. So too, it's necessary, I think, for us to insist that the authors were well aware of the fact that the capitalist revolution wasn't a once and for all event, but rather a sprawling, erratic, and bloody historical process over many years. I mean, hence that sense of, you know, from the discovery of the Cape, from the feudal social order. This is an event which takes 400 or 500 years. That's the nature of the capitalist revolution. And perhaps we could argue it's still ongoing, so extend that 500 years to 1,000 or to 800 or however long it ends up to be. This process, despite this language which sounds apocalyptic, a much longer historical framework, I think, is being suggested. One of the things that we notice is that in identifying capitalism as world transforming, so for them it's world breaking and world making. Capitalism breaks an old world apart, it makes an entirely new world. What they're doing then, obviously, is to posit a break in historical time. If you think of that metaphor of big ditch theory, capitalism is a big ditch in human history. So that they posit this break such that the whole period prior to the break comes to serve then as a conceptual foil against which to treat the empirical present. And this tendency, I want to suggest, is characteristic of the way of thinking that we term modern. We moderns tend to think in this way. We use the idea of a break to separate us from the past, and we then view the past in some sense as the other of the present. We think of the present in relation to a concept of the past which is defined by us. Think of the classic opposition between modernity or the modern and tradition or the traditional. Think of how we think of tradition. I'll say more about this in a moment. But the point being that tradition is viewed as the unmodern. If everything you would say about modernity, you define tradition as its opposite. In modern thought, we can say, the present sets itself off from the past, from which it is epochally different, or it sees itself as being epochally different. It sees the present, and perhaps I should stop saying it, I should say we, because the argument would be that we are very much moderns in this sense. So we see the present as a time of crisis, instability, flux, etc. Modern thought emphasizes the singularity and the fragility or tenuousness of the present, the present's radical difference from the past, which is henceforth understood as pre-modern or traditional. We also emphasize our openness to the future. In some sense. We look forward rather than backwards. So I'm making this point not to dispute what Marx and Engels say, obviously, but in order to draw your attention to their underlying assumptions about the present in relation to the past, to the mode of conceptualization that their argument exemplifies. I'm focusing on the method. If we think about the substance of their argument, we certainly recognize that there have been fundamental changes in pretty much every aspect of social and material life over the course of the past 500 years. Very often we focus on 1492 as the key event. That's the moment, obviously, where Columbus arrives in the Americas. It's also the moment at which Muslims and Jews are expelled from Granada and Andalusia in Spain. So it marks the moment of the discovery of the New World and also of the idea of Christendom defining itself in opposition to the other monotheistic religions. So if we ask ourselves what are the various kinds of determinants of the change, if, you know, what causes these changes? And we speak of capitalism, the form of the modern state, for instance, urbanization, industrialization, secularization, etc. It's here, I think, that Harman is quite useful, because what he suggests is, in order to understand how momentous these changes are, don't contrast, say, 1750 with 1850 or 1950. Contrast, let's say, 1250 with 1950, and then you understand the enormous changes. So when he speaks of, he says that 10th century feudalism was an overwhelmingly rural society. Almost the whole of the population lived off the land in more or less self-contained manorial villages. Control of each manor lay with the feudal lord, exercising political and juridical as well as economic power in the locality. Peasants were mostly serfs, unable to leave the manor, where they tilled strips of land for themselves, etc. Few towns, many town dwellers themselves tilling plots. Trade was carried out by traveling peddlers, the spies, etc. And so the point being that people barely moved more than 10 or 15 miles over the whole course of their lifetime. Languages spoken in one particular region could not be understood 50 miles away. The sense of tremendous kind of closeness, and it's worth thinking of this dialectal form. So we speak of English as the national language. But it is striking that not only as you move from England to Wales, for instance, but as you would move from one narrowly defined county to another, the languages were so altered that you could not understand what was being said. People, there was no contact between two communities 50 miles apart. And he contrasts then capitalism at its height, etc., and makes the obvious points. Urban life dominates. Great majority of the population work in industry or services. Money plays an absolutely central role, etc. So he's emphasizing that tremendous difference, and that's what we're talking about: the two forms of social formation that existed across these two periods. The changes then, from the 10th century to 20th century or 21st, include, as David Harvey explains, materially based transformations in the meanings of space and time. That's what's so interesting about Harvey's argument, I think, because it's not just that, as it were, we now live in towns and we now think in terms of exchange value or something like this, but the very notions of space and time change as a result of this process. So the modern age, going back, is understood as that for which the future has already begun. The modern age lives for the future, and it opens itself up to it. And here, just to take you through Habermas's argument there, he speaks of the secular concept of modernity expresses the conviction that the future has already begun. Look at some of the key terms. These terms all come into, some of them exist beforehand, but they come into popular usage in the 18th century only. Revolution itself, progress, enlightenment, emancipation, development, crisis, equality, some seeming to indicate a negative state of affairs, crisis obviously, others looking forward, but the sense of a forward-looking project. One speaks of progress as unfolding into the future, very, very strikingly. On the other side of the Great Divide then, so there's, here we are facing forwards, moving into the future. On the other side, what is there? There's the past, but the past understood as tradition, where presumably we say they did things differently. That sense of tradition. What is very striking and unusual about this, this is what I want you to take on board, is the sense that tradition is, of course, a modern concept in these terms. Those in the past, the tradition, in tradition, didn't walk around saying, we're traditional. They saw themselves, of course, as just living. That they are consigned to tradition by us across the Great Divide. Look at a couple of here again, these titles are not mine. Curious mixes of ancient tradition and modernity. The moment you put ancient there, you understand what modern thought does to the past. On the other side, where they do things differently, things do not change. We change, they don't. We're in the modern, they're not. A Fulani family zips by on a motorcycle, the driver's wife carries a toddler strapped to her back in a centuries-old African fashion. That sense of on the other side of the divide, tradition, the past, the ancient, things don't change. It's in a sense unchanging reality. On our side, they do. Of course, this idea of the ancient and the modern can then become the subject of humour, I suppose. I mean, this is another example which you find if you just type in modernity and tradition. You know, on the right, unchanging antiquity. On the left, modernity. So change, the now and the then, as it were. Another set of images which does the same thing, where we have tradition counterposed with modernity. Notice, though, that this image does begin to take us into interesting territories because it suggests that the old and the new are counterposed in some sense. The new doesn't obliterate the old. The new, as it were, refunctions the old or uses the old in some way. We can begin to speak about what sociologists call combined and uneven development. Combination and unevenness. It's as though people in the same time live in different times, or live according to different clocks, in some sense. But is one clock then always normative? Is the modern what gets to determine what is real time? These jokes that I was referring to, here's a lovely cartoon from Gary Larson, The Far Side, where what we find difficult, of course, is that on the other side of the divide, they are just like us, but without the resources. So there they were in the days before television, and they were already gathering themselves as a family to watch television in the evening. It's just that there were no TVs, so they had to stare at a blank wall. But the form of organization of the post-dinner family occasion was there. It was just, in other words, that there was nothing to see. Luckily, then, television was invented, so it gave them something to see. What Larson is focusing on here is the difficulty of moderns to understand that they did things differently in such a way that, of course, this is an unimaginable scene. In actual fact, here's another image: Dorea Potter, Egypt, tradition and modernity. Where here it seems as though in the traditional they did things exactly the same as we did, again with just different materials, different resources, and so on. So these are various kind of comments on this set of oppositions. Again, to return to Habermas. He suggests that the epochal new beginning, he says, is rendered constant with each moment that gives birth to the new. This is the next development of the argument, that it isn't as though the great ditch is one great ditch, as it were. You don't break with the past once and for all, and then you're in the now. The point is that once that Once that thought figure has been introduced, or once that mode has been introduced, it has to constantly be it has to constantly renew itself. You keep having to create ditches between yourself and the past. Think, for instance, of the language of generation in the development of computer technologies. So generation X, generation, you know, the next one, Microsoft generation, this and the next generation. Each generation, as it were, consigns all of the other generations to the past and sees itself as the present facing forward. But with each moment, you are actually stepping across another divide. So there are just divide, as it were. You're constantly having to make this particular break. A present that understands itself from the horizon of the modern as the actuality of the most recent has to recapitulate the break brought about with the past as a continuous renewal, says Habermas. And so I'm suggesting all this because we can see Marx and Engels doing exactly this, can't we, in the Communist Manifesto. Look at a couple of passages from 1848 to the present. This is where the handout that I gave you might be useful. You've looked at Marx and Engels, 1848. Have a look at Walter Benjamin, writing in 1930s. I think writing in the teens, really, but this essay is only published in 1936. And here he is focusing on the First World War, 1914 to 1918, as precisely that one of those moments of a radical break, separating fundamentally, categorically, absolutely, the present from the past. So he says that at the end of the war, men returned from the battlefield, grown silent, etc., and not richer but poorer in communicable experience. And then this key sentence, a generation that had gone to school on a horse-drawn streetcar now stood under the open sky in a countryside in which nothing remained unchanged but the clouds, and beneath these clouds, in a field of force of destructive torrents and explosions, was the tiny, fragile human body. We hear crisis, instability, flux of the present, measured against the stability and continuity of the past. But the past then understood, you could say that the past is not what it actually was. The past is the conceptual foil to the present, which is what I'm suggesting modern thought always does. It constructs the past as its other in some way. Jump forward to Eric Hobsbawm talking about the fall of historical communism, 1989. So this essay written in 92, and you'll see that exactly the same kind of thinking is in place. The events of recent years have been spectacular and world-changing and so on. Never before in history has ordinary human life and the societies in which it takes place been so radically transformed in so short a time, not merely within a single lifetime, but within part of a lifetime. This constant tendency to understand the events enveloping us as world-making, world-transforming, and pushing us inexorably into the future, which we have to look at, without resources in the past, because the present, the big ditch, separates you from the past. In some ways, you're cast adrift in the present. This is why the emphasis on secularity, in some way, because in fact, God cannot be used here as a kind of as a crutch, as an anchor, as a foundation, and so on. Obviously, the way in which this reference here to the events of 9/11, another characteristically modern response to an event, the day the world changed. 9/11 is another big ditch in human history. At least that's the way in which this, whoever wrote the headline here understands it. There's a before and an after. The after is governed by chaos, instability, danger. The past is understood as a more kind of stable, even-handed time frame. Here's John Bellamy Foster writing about the epochal crisis of the present. I mean, we'll look at this more next term, but particularly when we think about the Anthropocene. Isn't this how Anthropocene is also suggested? That in some ways we are enjoined to do things right now very radically, because if we don't, we will all die. Again, let me focus on the fact that I'm not making a comment about the substance of the argument here. This could be true. In fact, I believe it is true. But it's the methodology. We see this as a characteristically modern way of thinking. I'll use the term epochal crisis to refer to the convergence in such a way the material conditions of society as a whole are undermined, posing the question of a historical transition to a new mode of production. So we see that this argument of the capitalist revolution, say Marx and Engels, the First World War, says Benjamin, 9/11, says whoever wrote that headline, Anthropocene, says Benjamin. All of these things might be true. I'm not commenting on the substance of them. I'm getting you to look at the way in which these people are thinking through the categories. You can follow this process through Harvey, I think. It's important to challenge the idea of a single and objective sense of time or space. That's such a deceptively simple-sounding comment, but it's very difficult to think. Because, of course, we do think of time and space as somehow stable. When we think of our understanding of the heavens, for instance, or of the universe, we tend to think of our own standpoint as the scientifically correct one, and to view others as being false. The Great Ditch is also an epistemological ditch. We move from superstition into enlightenment, or from error into truth. Through the things. And what Harvey is suggesting is the multiplicity of the objective qualities which time and space can express. The idea that time and space express something is very difficult for us to think. It's not common sense in any way. Look at something. Has anyone seen the Mapa Mundi in Hereford, or any of the Mapa Mundis? Anyone? You should go. It's not far to Hereford. So this is one of a series of map of the world, right? And you'll notice so this is a medieval map of the world. It's in a chain library. You have to get the book. It comes out to you on a giant chain. You open it up, and it's in there. So this is at the center of them. The point about this map, which bears no relationship, of course, to any kind of contemporary map. Here's another one. Jerusalem is at the center. This is obviously a Christocentric worldview. Jerusalem is at the center, and right next door to Jerusalem is Hereford, which is where, of course, the person, the monk who's making it is. How would you see the world? You see it, in other words, this is the world from my perspective. This is how I see the world. The world radiates out from here, but of course, God is at the centerpiece. All of the great rivers of the world converge in Jerusalem. So the Ganges, the Nile, the Amazon, I'm not sure the Amazon is there, because I don't think the Amazon is known, but certainly the Ganges and the Nile, and the Yangtze and the Thames are all rivers coming in and out of Jerusalem from this map. The way in which the map is a registration of the way in which the world is seen by this particular map maker. When I was in Jordan a couple of years ago, I went down to, I can't remember the name of the place. I think I've written it down somewhere. It's in Madaba in Jordan, where the same Mapa Mundis, or maps of the world, were made, in this case, in mosaic. Here again you have, this is the Holy Land, basically maps of Palestine from the 12th century or 13th century. And here the 6th century, excuse me, map. But again, if you notice this, it's marked by the fact that an idea of objective spatiality, as we would call it, is not available to this person. Instead, this is a personalized map This map could not, besides the fact that it's mosaic, it can't be folded up, as it were, and taken elsewhere where it would be usable. Maps are only from where you are. But of course, we like to think of our maps as being completely different from this. The conclusion we should draw, says Harvey, is simply that neither space nor time can be assigned objective meanings independently of material processes. The objective qualities as well as the meanings of space and time, he says, also change. Here he is then trying to describe this process. I mean, here he's talking about the shrinking of the world, 1500 to 1840, relatively speaking. He's talking about the best average speed of horse-drawn coaches and sailing ships was 10 miles an hour in the beginning. As the world shrinks, he's talking about the way in which capitalism causes the world to shrink. So that he wants us to entertain the idea that the world for us is not the same as the world for those who preceded us. And that is difficult to think, because we like to think, well, we're still people, as it were, we're still human, there is still spatiality. But think for instance of how the automobile pulverizes space. Not only how, of course, in the name of the automobile, town planners, city planners and so on, think differently, that roads become central in a way that they never were before. But just think of how distance changes as a result. The idea of space and time. And we still confront something of this difficulty of thinking through these categories when we, if you move, for instance, from a country of population density and relative smallness, Britain, for instance, to a different country, Australia, say, or the United States. I taught for 1 year in Louisiana, and I was shocked by, not so much in Louisiana itself, but more particularly Texas, right next door. People would think nothing of driving 350 miles to a one way to a college football game. Which struck me as insane. I'd say, it's 350 miles, I would say. And they would look at me as though, you know, yes, it is, they would say. As though that was, but it was extraordinary that for me that would be, I couldn't get my head around the idea that that's what one would do, as it were. For them it was perfectly routine. They're used to thinking in these, do they then inhabit the same notion of time and space as I do? And the suggestion that Harvey draws us towards is probably not, I think. Spatial practices derive their efficacy in social life only through the structure of social relations in which they come into play. Spatial practices portrayed in this grid become imbued with class meanings. So he says that they take on their meanings under specific social relations of class, gender, community, ethnicity, or race, and get used up or worked over in the course of social action. So the suggestion here is for a radical historicization, in some sense, and a radical geographicalization of space and time. We have to think of these not, as it were, as objective measures. It is 11,000 miles to Beijing. That seems to have an objective ring to it. But in fact, if we're talking about specific social formations, specific sets of exchanges between those two, there's a wonderful moment in Amitav Ghosh's novel. I forget the title of this. It'll come back to me in a moment. But where he takes a compass and basically just draws a not a compass, that thing, what's that thing called that you make a protractor, is it, or that you make circles on a compass. And he puts it on London and he stretches it to, so it represents, say, 200 miles, and one understands one particular history, anything within the 200 miles of London. He puts exactly the same distance on Dhaka in Bangladesh, And if you look at what's implicated within that, it's an entirely different history. So the same space, as it were, but an entirely different set of historical meanings. Harvey speaks then about the progressive monetization of relations in social life transforms the qualities of time and space. One more image that I found, which is the speed, two charts of the speed at which news travels to Venice, Venice being the capital of the of a particular world system in 1570. But on the one understands on the on the left, much slower. So that sense of the world being a much bigger place, or more remote, or only things that happen in one place matter, the world becomes much larger and much faster by 1700. So progressive monetization of relations in social time, says Harvey, and he bids us to think about Holbein's extraordinary painting of the ambassadors. I mean, the ambassadors already indicates a kind of set of exchanges. But if you look at he focuses obviously on this distorted mirror here. Is that the moment at which Holbein introduces a certain critique? But because it's the pomposity and the importance of the men that matters. But if you look at what they're wearing, if you look at the globes and so on, you understand that for them, very self-consciously, their power is in some ways an index of their ability to command time and space. This is the key moment. They're wearing these things. They are able to, and the suggestion is that Holbein is actually criticizing this. In fact, through a Christian reference, so holding up the idea of in some sense vanity or the inescapability of death, that perhaps is a death mask, which gives the lie to their self-understanding. But their self-understanding is very much that it's their ability to command time and space that is so crucial here. Or alternatively, that notion of a pyramidal structure, the financial elites, who are able to control time and space. And therefore, what we begin to understand with Harvey here is that time and space become struggles. That one struggles for the ability to control time. It's not just that one struggles for more money, as it were. That's not what class relations are all about. In some sense, class relations are about who gets to determine what time is and how time should be used, under what circumstances. We're beginning to see here that historicization involves the ability to think difference in profound ways. Not in a relativistic way. What we're coming up with are arguments that are materialist in the sense that they're looking for the causes of things underlying them. But things are very, very different for Harman's 10th century peasants and for ourselves. And we need to understand the set of relations. It's partly that we have to understand the past not as unchanging tradition, and not as ourselves as though the time of the now is unique in some sense. But on the contrary, how do you historicize the present? And it's difficult to do because we tend to heroize the present all the time. We tend to imagine it as this key moment. So when Harvey writes that he wants to signal processes that so revolutionize the objective qualities that we're forced to alter, sometimes in quite radical ways, how we represent the world to ourselves. Compression obviously describes a certain set of effects. As space appears to shrink, and as time horizons shorten to the point where the present is all there is, which is the world also of the schizophrenic, so we've learned how to cope with an overwhelming sense of compression of our spatial and temporal worlds. This is Harvey's argument. It's his attempt, in some sense, to historicize the modern, where the modern tends not to be able to historicize itself, except in terms of this one punctual radical break. But I take it that people like Habermas and Harvey, by emphasizing this continuous renewal, are trying to get us to see a much larger kind of thought figure, a way in which we tend to think. I mean, it is the case, isn't it, that we're constantly viewing yesterday as the distant past, Today is where we are, but then the moment something else happens, we have crossed another great divide, which means that we have to bracket all of that stuff as well. That constant move forwards, without a sense of the becoming of this present. There's a way in which, as we're moving forward, so the ground on which we are out of which the present has developed becomes difficult for us to get hold of. It may be that it's no longer relevant, but it becomes difficult for us to grasp. It is quite hard for us to historicize our present conditions, partly because, of course, we could argue that capitalism tends to eternalize itself. This seems to be the only world in which we could live, as well as the only world in which we do live. And if one thinks that, it becomes very difficult to grasp the historicality of the present, which is what Marx and Engels were attempting to do. So this is, I'm suggesting that there's some kind of contradictions around here, attempting to historicize the present, but in fact, maybe not getting that right because they tend to traditionalize the past, seems to be something that characterizes modern thought overall. I think that's a good place to stop, I guess. According to the PowerPoint, it's exactly the place to stop. Let's focus tomorrow. Certainly, any issues coming up from the manifesto should be talked about. But have a look again at Harvey's argument, and let's try and focus on some of what he says, because sometimes his writing is actually quite difficult to grasp. So we can spend some time focusing on that. Thank you.